Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. It was a time when lead poisoning meant getting shot by a Colt 45, and a neck stretching was the price paid for stealing a horse. Life in the Wild West in the late 1800s was filled with bigger-than-life characters. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Jesse James and Pancho Villa, to name just a few. No outlaw was more notorious, however, than Billy the Kid. Author Michael Wallace has written a new book about the boy who became a legend. It's titled Billy the Kid. Michael Wallace joins me in the studio, and we will invite your calls, 800-433-8850, or you can join us by email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, Michael. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
I must say, Billy the Kid is something in my own mind of a legend, but he was a very real person. He didn't start out as Billy the Kid.
No, he didn't. He had quite a ride. In fact, a ride that's why the subtitle, Billy the Kid, the Endless Ride, a ride that seems to go on. But he started out in a much different place than New Mexico territory, where he finally ended up. He started, the best we know, in the slums of New York, in the Irish slums of New York, before the Civil War, where he was born in 1859 to a Irish widow, famine Irish, Catherine McCarty, and where she had her two sons. Henry McCarty was his given name, and his brother Joseph McCarty.
How do we know all this?
Well, we know this because of a lot of folks who came before me. You know, there have been literally hundreds of books, as you can imagine, written about Billy the Kid, and twice that many or three times that many articles, and then we get into the whole film thing. And it's very difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff, but there are, thankfully, some landmark works, certainly before mine. And through research and through personal accounts of people that we were able to acquire before they passed on, and you need to be very careful with those as well, we're able to determine some things about this young man.
I'm interested in your interest in Billy the Kid and how it developed. I gather you actually met a man who knew him.
Well, you know, I met a man who claimed he knew him, and that was back in 1969. You know, I was on my way from Santa Fe down to El Paso on a Christmas Eve night, and my car broke down. I was towed into the town of Socorro, up on the upper edge of Billy the Kid country, and an old-timer appeared out of the shadows, and we shared a bit of whiskey-laced thermos coffee together, and he told me his stories, and one of them was that he knew the kid. And I was trying to do the math at the time, and I figured this guy had to be Methuselah, but he went on, and And I already knew or thought I knew a lot about Billy at that time and went on from there. I also met Jarvis Garrett many years later, the son of Pat Garrett, the man who killed the kid. In fact, held the gun that killed the kid. So all through my life, I've had these little moments. As someone said, I've been bumping into Billy for, 61 years.
So you finally decided to really settle in and do some research on it.
I did. You know, growing up in the great outlaw state of Missouri, where we produced some of the best outlaws, the James Gang, Bell Star, the Youngers, etc., and I won't even get into our white-collar outlaws up there, it was typical of me as a boy growing up in the late 40s and 50s to hear stories of Jesse James, Billy the Kid, Pretty Boy Floyd, all the litany of gangsters and outlaws. And, of course, I was always told that his name was William Bonney and that he killed 21 men, one for every year of his life, and that he was probably a bit of a psychopath. But as I grew older and started learning more and sifting through things, I took much of that with a grain of salt. And ultimately, I decided it's time to help set the record straight and let's get to the truth. Not rewrite history, but tell the truth.
Set the stage for us. What was the world like in Billy the Kid's time?
Billy the Kid's time roughly, or even precisely, was from 1859 to 1881 when he died on the evening of Bastille Day, 1881, in New Mexico Territory. And so if you follow his life westward from New York to New Mexico, you get a pretty good idea of what was going on in the country during that period. And, of course, right off the bat, we have the Civil War.
What
a major impact that had.
Yeah.
And then you have the continuation of manifest destiny, of a taking of the land, of conquering other cultures, of possessing the land and the mineral rights and the water. And you have the Gilded Age and all the corruption and turmoil that came with that. So it was a very important period.
His mother, as you said, was a widow. She had two sons. She died very young.
She did die very young, in her mid-40s, and she died from what they called consumption, tuberculosis. She died with her two boys at her side in Silver City, New Mexico. She had remarried a man named William Antrim, who she took up with in Indianapolis on their westward journey, and then in Wichita, Wild and Willie Wichita, and Kansas, Denver, down in New Mexico. Like a lot of folks stricken with a horrible disease, she was wandering, looking for a cure, seeking a healthy clime, and that's what brought them to the Southwest. And that's indeed where she died when her boys were just teenagers. And they were on the street because their stepfather, William Antrim, had little to do with them. And he was off on his own mining adventures.
Michael Wallace, he's the author of 13 books, including Route 66 and Pretty Boy Floyd. His new book is titled Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. During this whole period, you really did have a rise in crime rates. They actually skyrocketed.
Well, what you had And this is a good point, because what I tried to do, and I hope I've done in this book, it's what I did in my book about Charles Floyd, the Pretty Boy book, is use these young men, these outlaws, if you will, as a vehicle to tell the story of those times. And as we just talked about, there was so much going on, both good, bad, and ugly, between 1859 and 1881. You know, that whole Civil War impact on American culture, on American life, and certainly the destiny of the West can't be ignored. We all know how the impact the Civil War had, certainly on this country, and ripples of it felt to this day. But it truly did increase the rise of our gun culture. Americans, as we've been told, have always had a love affair with guns, with firearms, with weaponry, going back certainly through colonial times. But up until the time of the Civil War, you were more likely to die by being beaten to death or stabbed. After the Civil War, in 1865 and forever on to this day, it was the gun. The gun was the number one way to die, and we armed America. Colt and Remington grew to be very prosperous during the Civil War, and at the end of the war, these young men who did survive came home. And there was no Civil War syndrome. Many of them came home not only with broken bodies and limbless, but they came back with broken minds. There was a great deal of insanity, suicide rates, and so forth. And unfortunately, they all came home with their weapons, even the Confederates.
But this was not a time when Billy the Kid, or the man who became Billy the Kid, had been involved in the Civil War. He was far too young for that, but he was affected and infected by this culture of guns.
Oh, there's no question. The little brood of the McCartys, of Catherine and her boys, by the end of the war were briefly in Indianapolis and then moving westward on their own little manifest destiny journey. But the men that the Kid eventually collided with, joined with, fought against, merged with, whatever, were veterans, a lot of them, of the Civil War. Like him, a lot of them were Irish. Some of them were corrupt. Some of them were a bit more wholesome, but they were all armed to the teeth, and violence was a way of life.
Michael Wallace, and we're talking about his new book, Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. Do join us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. If you've just joined us, Michael Wallace is with me. His newest book is titled Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride, all about the young man who became really a machine of killing, claiming to have killed one man for each year of his 21-year life. I want to know what Billy the Kid looked like, Michael.
The Kid was lithe, athletic. I'm talking about at his, well, he certainly never reached his prime, of course, because he died at 21, but was roughly about 5'7", wiry, There's only one photo of Billy, the famous tintype. There have been many pretenders, but the photo, as his contemporaries said, including some of his senoritas, it was not very flattering. But he was said to be a handsome, cheerful young man, very musical, was just one heck of a dancer. He was a superb dancer, went to all the fandangos and dances, musically inclined, loved to sing, was said to often be seen riding and whistling as he went through the countryside. All in all, most of his contemporaries, especially, of course, those who rode with him, described him as a good old boy.
Why, in your view, did he become the killer he became?
Simply put, although he was said to have killed 21 men, and that takes in a lot of people before me, other historians and researchers, I'm only comfortable saying he probably killed 4 men. Others say 4 to 8, and then you get into all kinds of arguments. But the myth about him, and such as the myth of how many men he killed and all of this, really started, obviously, in his own lifetime. I'm very sympathetic toward Billy. I don't make excuses for him. I retain my objectivity. But I think he was used by a great many people. I think he made a lot of mistakes, a lot of them youthful mistakes. He was, after all, a kid. But he went on a trail all of his own that he had to follow. And then the timing was so poor for him. Becoming involved in movements and episodes of history much bigger than him, and actually used by many as a scapegoat, as a pawn, and so forth, especially when he got into what we now call the Lincoln County War, one of the many major skirmishes that went on in the Southwest. But it was his youth. It was his charming Billy boyness. It was all of that added to this mystique in the people he came across. And then he was seized upon by the journalists of that day, by the dime novelists, by the yellow press, and even in his own lifetime. He wasn't called Billy the Kid until the last 8 or 9 months of his life.
Huh.
Yeah.
Do we know who was his first victim?
His first victim was Francis Cahill, better known as Windy Cahill. He was a bully blacksmith, another Irishman, a former soldier out in Arizona near an army post where Billy was residing. This is shortly after he went on the scout, as we call it, out on the outlaw trail. And he was doing some minor, today we'd have called him a car thief, but back then there were no cars. He was stealing horses and tack and saddles and dealing kino and monte. And this blacksmith used to rough him up a bit. And one night he was really roughing up Billy, and Billy pulled out his gun and shot him in the belly, and the blacksmith died the next day, but Billy was long gone. He ran. He ran several times, and this was a mistake, some say, because he perhaps could have been acquitted on self-defense, but others say he was probably smart to run because Windy Cahill's pals would have probably taken care of him, and he would have been decorating a cottonwood down along one of the gulches. But he did run, and we know that was his first victim. Although there are others that say that he killed a man when he was 12 and so forth, I find none of that believable.
Was he particularly adept with a gun, more so than others?
Apparently, from what we can tell, he became adept at both with firearms and on horseback. And I think this was, again, a function of survival. When he was turned out on the streets, literally at 14, and as a 14, 15, 16-year-old youth trying to make his way in life, he had to learn how to survive, and this is how he did it, with these tools.
You tracked down the first published story about Billy the Kid, or as he was better known than, Henry McCarty. What did that story in the Silver City Herald tell us?
Well, there were the Silver City Herald was a treasury for me, and of all those great archival papers from that period in the 1870s when Henry and his family lived there, and there were stories about him taking part in dramas. For instance, he was a bit of a thespian. He and his brother Joseph, or Josie, as he was better known, got some actual formal schooling there, a bit crude, but actually schooling, and he was known as one of the street Arabs, the name for these kids who were running around on the streets pulling pranks.
Street Arabs?
Yes.
How interesting.
Yeah, yeah. But he was sort of a typical mischievous boy then. Interesting, though, and what a lot of people don't realize, it was there that he became very proficient in the Spanish language. And he could speak Spanish, some say, like a native. He was very literate. We have examples of the letters he later wrote when he was trying to negotiate a deal with Governor Lew Wallace, the governor of New Mexico Territory, who was...
What kind of a deal?
Well, he had been promised immunity by the government for some testimony by Lew Wallace. Lew Wallace had been a famous Civil War general who presided over the Lincoln trials of the assassins.
No relation to you, I presume.
No, it's he spells his name, or spelled his name, W-A-L-L-A-C-E, and I am W-A-L-L-I-S.
All right.
Sounds the same. But he came out of Indiana, became territorial governor of New Mexico, but was really more concerned with finishing a novel he was writing called Ben-Hur, which came out and became a huge bestseller. And but during the brief time that Wallace was there, he actually had a clandestine meeting with the kid and promised him immunity, but then later reneged. But we have the correspondence back and forth between them. So there are a lot of surprises that I came upon with this kid.
But you call his 17th year a pivotal one in his life when he picked up Kid Antrim. And that's what he was called for quite a while.
He was. Throughout the book, and instead of just focusing on the Lincoln County War, which a lot of books do about Billy the Kid the last few years of his life, I wanted to tell the complete story. That's why I start with his birth and origin, or as much as we can possibly know, and then move forward. But wherever I am in the action of the book, I'm using the name he went by then, Henry McCarty. Then after Santa Fe and his mother married William Antrim, then Henry Antrim. Then when he went on the scout, he became known as Kid Antrim. And the moniker Kid was not necessarily that of an outlaw. A lot of people were called Kid this or Kid that back then. Even back in the teeming city of New York, we had a lot of kids, Kid Schultz or whatever. But sometimes he was called the Wandering Kid because he was prone to wander.
But you have mentioned the Lincoln County War several times. Tell us about that and how he got involved.
The Lincoln County War was not just people often confuse it with other wars and say it was a cattle war. It wasn't that. I mean, obviously, where you have ranches, there are always cattle involved. But it was a clash between two forces, primarily a remittance man, a young Englishman named John Tunstall, who moved into Lincoln County, which was quite large at that time, physically.
Where is Lincoln County?
Lincoln County is in... At that time, it covered good part of south central down to the extreme southern New Mexico.
Okay.
There are mountain ranges, there are streams, and there's that lovely rolling adobe earth of New Mexico spotted with pinon and cedar and sage. And these little towns, historic Hispanic communities. There were also Native Americans throughout that area. But John Tunstall, this dandy Englishman, partnered with Alexander McSween, a Scotsman, and they formed a mercantile company that was in direct competition with what was called the House. And that was an Irish concern. Lawrence Murphy, Dolan, a knot of men, primarily veterans from the Army who had become corrupt in the Army and then came out into civilian life and continued their corrupt ways as landlords, as taking money from people by accumulating debts at their store and so forth, throughout and out theft. And they were part of a greater organization known as the Santa Fe Ring, controlled by Boss Catron, Thomas Catron, the political boss of New Mexico, who later became, when New Mexico became a state in 1912, its first senator. And Boss Catron pulled the string. So this was the clash that was going on. It broke out to actual warfare. Both Tunstall and McSween were eventually killed, shot and killed. And by that time, the kid, Kid Antrim, now going by the name William H. Bonney, and we're not sure where that came from.
Gosh.
We think it might be a family name on his mother's side that he pulled out. There are many, many theories, and most of which I present in this book. He rode, Billy Bonney rode, with the faction opposing the House.
Oh, I see.
And they called themselves the Regulators. And eventually, through death, shooting deaths, he eventually worked his way up in the hierarchy of the Regulators, this young man.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And we're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Lane. You're on the air.
Good morning. Just a quick question. I wondered if in your research, Mr. Wallace, if you had ever debunked the claims of Brushy Bill Roberts in Hyco, Texas, that he was, in fact, Billy the Kid?
Yes, I do. I debunk all those claims. You know, that was one of the primary ones, and this was a many people, there are always conspiracy theories surrounding notable deaths, you know, whether it's a president or an outlaw. And there were always claimants that Billy wasn't killed, that it was somebody else that was killed, and he and Pat Garrett formed a pact and all kinds of tangents and so forth. But there's, in my mind, let me put it this way, there's no question in my mind that on the cusp of that night, on July 14th, 1881, near the witching hour, right after, that Pat Garrett shot and killed Henry McCarty and killed him dead. McCarty was died and buried the next day, but Billy the Kid rode on his endless ride. And I feel very strongly about that, as do most credible historians.
I hope that answers it, Lane.
Absolutely. Thank you, Diane. Welcome back.
Thank you. And for those of you with young children, you no doubt recognize my guest voice as that of the sheriff from the animated Pixar movie Cars. How many movies have you done, Michael?
Well, that was my first animated film. You know, obviously, first and foremost, I'm an author, and before that, I've been a journalist. I've been writing since the late 60s, but...
You have a wonderful voice.
Well, I do. It's developed through the years, but I've always been a print person, you see. But people have always encouraged me to get out, and then through the years, because of the publication of my books, I did more and more public speaking and presentations, and then led finally to doing a lot of voice work and narration with various things, the History Channel and other networks and PBS and so forth, to the point where I finally had to not only have, of course, my literary agent, but a speaking agent, a voice agent. And then that led to my involvement with Pixar. And lo and behold, I went from being their consultant because of my Route 66 work to becoming the voice of the sheriff of Radiator Springs.
What was that experience like?
It was a hoot. It was probably the most fun I've ever had in my life.
Really?
It was. First of all, I wasn't having to write. I started out, as I said, 6 years ago as a consultant for Pixar, working with John Lasseter, the great creative head of Pixar, now Disney, and that creative bunch out of Emeryville, California, and I took them out on my road. They wanted to develop a full-length motion picture animated movie about Route 66 and this race car who gets lost and finds himself in this mythical town of Radiator Springs. And I jumped at the chance to become their consultant. I literally took them out of my road, gave them my road. They devoured it. They took it in big gulps and loved it. We stopped every 200 yards, which I love to do, and they examined roadkill. They moved box turtles off the road. They waded in the fields of winter wheat. They ate all the wrong foods. They met hitchhikers, grease monkeys. And those are the scenes and those are the people that you find now in this wonderful, delicious film that has done so much for my road, Route 66.
Michael Wallace, we're talking not only about his film and voice work, but about his most recent book. It's titled Billy the Kid: The Endless Ride. We'll take more of your calls when we return. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., celebrating the Year of the Spy and shedding light on current events through the history of espionage. Tickets at spymuseum.org. Additional support for NPR comes from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage, and from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Joe Boyd was the stage manager when Dylan went electric at Newport. Boyd produced recordings by Pink Floyd, the Incredible String Band, Fairport Convention, and Nick Drake, and ran a psychedelic rock club in London. On the Next Fresh Air, we talk with Joe Boyd about making music in the 60s. Join us for the Next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. Michael Wallace is with me. We've been talking about his brand new book titled Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. He's the author of 13 books, including Route 66 and Pretty Boy Floyd. Let's go back to the phones now and to Another call from San Antonio, Texas. Hi there, Eric. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Mr. Wallace, I wanted to ask you what, in your view, is the tendency we have to romanticize, even lionize, guys like Billy the Kid and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
It's a very good question, Eric, and we always have. It was less than a year after the Kid was killed at Fort Sumner, and right after Jesse James was shot down by the Ford boys up in St. Joe. It was in 1882. During his lecture tour of the United States, he was in Denver. None other than Oscar Wilde put it this way: Americans have always worshipped their heroes, and they tend to take them from the outlaw class. It's just in our nature. And these people go in and out of favor. You know, certainly the Kid has, Billy the Kid has. Sometimes he's the devil incarnate, and sometimes he's an avenging angel. But primarily, every time this country has had a crippling depression, the depression following the Civil War in 1873, the early 1870s, the Great Depression of 1893, the depression of the 1930s, we have a crop of bandits, social bandits that pop up that, unbeknownst to them, become folk heroes of the disenfranchised, whether it's Pretty Boy Floyd or Billy the Kid or Jesse James.
Does that answer it, Eric?
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for calling, sir. Let's go now to Syracuse, New York. Sean, good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane and Mr. Wallace.
Good morning.
I have a history in New Mexico. My great-grandfather settled in Roswell back in the around 1900, and we still have a property in Lincoln County, and I go back often. My mother still lives there, and I've been fascinated with Billy the Kid since I was a young boy and still am. But what strikes me as interesting is you mentioned the education level of Billy the Kid and correspondence. A lot of that correspondence I've read, it's in the museums, of course, and it all strikes me as how well-educated and intelligent and how well Billy the Kid could actually write. And it's interesting to me compared to sort of the level of many just individuals of his age who probably even had on books more education. What do you think is sort of the cultural differences between now and back then in terms of, you know, how people were educated, even who ended up being outlaws?
Yeah.
Yeah, because generally the schools were very, very poor. And, of course, it varied. And what we had in Silver City finally were a couple of men and women who came along who were quite diligent. But that's what fascinates me about the Kid, because he sort of went against the grain. And I think a lot of this we have to attribute to Catherine McCarty, his mother. I really do. That's where my money would lie, on Catherine as the major influence of his life.
And believing in education.
But believing in education. But you see, he wasn't the stereotypical Irishman. He rarely drank at all throughout his life. But he was musical. He did have those gypsy feet. But also, there was so much racism back then, as always. And he didn't get involved in that. In fact, he embraced the Hispanic culture, which was totally different from his friends. He did speak fluent Spanish. He often liked to dress in some of the Hispanic costume. And he liked a sombrero. He liked beaded moccasins. He loved the cuisine. And he certainly loved the señoritas.
But the question of the code of behavior of those men, young boys, young men in the West, was certainly you never back down from a fight.
No, that was the code of the West. No retreat. No retreat. You know, and there was a great deal of machismo, of course, but that was the way. There was a retired staffer from the National Park Service, Jack Rigney, who I have a lot of respect for, who ran a lot of the wonderful monument there at Lincoln County in Lincoln, in the town of Lincoln, New Mexico, sort of one of the epicenters of Billy the Kid country. And Jack put it to me this way. In fact, I even use that quote in the book. What we had there in Lincoln County at the time were a lot of teenage boys with guns drunk. And it sounds a little familiar that their drug of choice was alcohol, horrible raw spirits. But they were well armed, and there was violence was a way of life.
He did choose to make an escape, but if he was backed against a wall, if he was threatened, what could he do? Could he shoot and be within the law, or could he make an escape and still have his stature?
You know, it's a difficult call. I would say out of the four, for sure, homicides that the kid committed, two of them could be called self-defense.
Really?
Two of them, and the two that you're talking about with the escape, the famous escape that he made from the Lincoln County Jail, which ironically by that time was in the building called the House, where his former enemies had operated, he killed two guards, including one that had bullied him a lot. Whether he needed to kill them both, it's hard to say.
And these are two we know about.
Oh, we know about it because there were witnesses there. That was a very famous event, and there's where he rode off, and instead of riding south and the classic ride into Old Mexico, he stayed around in New Mexico territory, we believe because of a young woman or two that had caught his eye and that he did have a close association with. And that proved to be his downfall because that's where he was shot and killed.
All right, let's go to Indianapolis. Good morning, Susan. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Mr. Wallace, I called to tell you that I am the great-great-granddaughter of Louis Bozeman, who was deputized by Pat Garrett and was on the posse when they captured Billy the Kid. And my great aunt, Louis Bozeman's granddaughter, is still alive. And she has told me many times the story of how she heard from her grandfather about how the kid was captured.
You're talking about at Stinking Springs.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a very, very famous incident in
Stinking Springs.
Stinking Springs, New Mexico. A lovely name, isn't it? That's what ultimately. First of all, I'm delighted to talk to you. You're the great great granddaughter of Mr. Bozeman.
Yes, I am.
Oh, that's wonderful. And it's how ironic that you're living in a town where the kid once lived.
When I heard that just a few moments ago on the show, I had no idea. I've never heard that before.
Oh, that's great. Well, that was a very famous incident, which we describe in much detail in the book.
Well, I am looking forward to reading it and letting other members of my family know about it. They'll be very interested.
Well, I'm pleased to talk to you.
Thanks for calling, Susan.
Thanks.
And now to Salt Lake City, Utah. Bob, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I grew up in Silver City, New Mexico, actually in a little town of Gila. And my mother said she knew Billy the Kid's mom. She died when she was very late in life. So she was quite old when my mom knew her.
Billy's mother was in her mid-40s when she died.
Okay, and what year would that have been?
1874.
Okay, now, Bob, would your mother have been alive at that year?
No. She was born in 1912.
Okay.
And grew up in Silver City, and maybe she was mistaken, but there's also a lot of myths around there. My great-grandfather either worked in or ran a saloon in Silver City where the legend goes that Billy the Kid actually was in a gunfight or actually shot one of his first people when he was a young boy. I don't know if this is true, but it's been a good story to tell over the years.
Well, and I appreciate that. And believe me, I go through this a lot, and I never like to challenge people's personal family stories because they're great treasures. And I say this with all respect, but the kid didn't kill anyone in Silver City. He did. His stepfather and his brother and frequented some of the bars and gambling establishments. He worked at some when he was a kid, and he did learn how to play cards quite well in Silver City. But there was no homicides on his part there.
Michael, did he ever have to face a jury?
Oh, yes. He was ultimately found guilty in Mesilla, New Mexico, down near Las Cruces, for the murder of Sheriff William Brady in Lincoln. And that's when he was moved back to Lincoln County. That's when he made his
escape.
And you talk about it's so interesting. It wasn't that long ago. We're talking to these people today whose great mother remembers, or my great grandfather. The other day in Albuquerque, I was talking to someone, and her great great grandfather was William Brady. And she was fascinated to talk to me, and I to her.
Michael, it seems so unlikely that this smart young man who knew he was going to be pursued when he broke out of jail, that he would not have gone as far as he could away from that jail. Why do you suppose he made that mistake?
Because I think his eye had been greatly turned by a certain senorita, perhaps a couple of them, up in the Fort Sumner area. And that kept him there. Love is very strong, and certainly he needed all the love he could find. So this renegade motherless child stayed in New Mexico territory.
And Pat Garrett and two other lawmen tracked him down.
They tracked him down. They did indeed. And contrary to popular belief, Garrett, this extremely tall Texan who had a sort of checkered past of his own, didn't run with Billy, didn't cook up some kind of bogus shooting death. He killed him. And of course, Garrett himself in 1908 was shot and killed in the back. He was on a ride, stopped while relieving himself along the road. Somebody shot him in the back and bushwhacked him.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Read for us a little bit from the book, would you, Michael?
This is back at the very end, from a chapter called El Chivato, one of his names, this little Billy who became a folk hero of many people. And this is just near the end. As Garrett sat on the bed, waiting in Maxwell's room, the kid gave in to his hunger pangs. He picked up a butcher knife in Celsus' kitchen and walked outside to cut some meat from a freshly slaughtered yearling hanging from a beam on Maxwell's porch. The kid had taken off his sombrero and boots, and as he shuffled down the porch in his stocking feet, the two deputies saw him. Poe later said the kid was bareheaded and seemed to be buttoning his trousers as he walked. In the dark, Poe thought it was either Maxwell or one of his guests. But it wasn't. It was Billy asking the question, "Quién es? Quién es? Who is it? Who is it?" And it was a question that was never answered, because then he backed into a darkened room where Pat Garrett was waiting, sitting on the bed with Pete Maxwell, and where he shot him. So this question was never answered. The kid died hungry and with his boots off.
And there was an obituary that was done.
There were lots of course, his news of his death flashed around the world, and Garrett soon after that wrote one of the first books about Billy the Kid, one filled with a lot of mistruths and exaggerations. The London News ran a summary of his life, and the New York Daily Graphic, all the papers. But one of the more sensational obituaries appeared in the Santa Fe Weekly Democrat, where they said this: No sooner had the floor caught the descending form, which had a pistol in one hand and a knife in the other, than there was a strong odor of brimstone in the air, and a dark figure with the wings of a dragon, claws like a tiger, eyes like balls of fire, and horns like a bison, hovered over the corpse for a moment, and with a fiendish laugh said, "Ha ha, this is my meat," and then sailed off through the window. He did not leave his card, but he is a gentleman well known by reputation, and thereby hangs a tale.
Wow.
It's quite an obituary.
Quite an obituary. Do you share, in some ways, you said earlier, you know, you're a supporter of Billy the Kid. What's your final view?
Well, I'm not some... perhaps a supporter. More, I have sympathy for the kid, and I remain objective about him. You know, he just didn't commit all the high crimes and misdemeanors that we think he did, that I thought he did when I played Billy the Kid in Guns out on the lawn in Missouri in the 50s. I'll put it to you this way. If I were alive back then in Lincoln County, 19, 20 years old, I would have been riding with the kid.
I love that. Michael Wallace, his new book is titled Billy the Kid, The Endless Ride. He's also the voice of the sheriff from the animated Pixar movie Cars. Michael, it was delicious to meet you.
Oh, it was great to be here.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anderson answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.